Right, welcome to this class on the management of innovation projects, the management of innovation processes. This class, we're going to talk about managing the innovation process. We're going to talk about the role of management accounting and secrecy in that process. And we're going to try to relate each of these to how they shape the way innovation plays out in organizations. Where last lesson, we were very much looking at how innovation can take place and how you can have various efforts to try to organize innovation so as to make space for transcending the productivity dilemma. This class, we're going to dive into some much more micro reflections about it, really, and some, I would say, more organizationally complex processes around it. So the question is going to be, how is it that you actually can control innovation processes, not through organizational design or particular ways of enacting management, creating particular context, but through the design of the control mechanisms that you use. I'm going to open the talk with some reflections on creativity generally. It's something that we've been glossing over thus far. And then I'll talk a little bit about the standard image of how innovation projects get managed, namely by looking at Cooper's idea of stage gate systems. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll move on to the papers by Jan Mowitz and his colleagues on management accounting, and the paper by Augstorfer on bootlegging. Okay. As I mentioned, we're going to start off with just having a few comments about creativity and the fact that we have thus far taken it sort of for granted. It would be super relevant to engage with the research that exists on creativity and the role and the way that creative processes play out. We're not going to cover that in this part of the course, and we're not going to talk so much about how to get people to have better ideas or how to get them to be creative in the first place. But we have kind of been touching upon it somewhat indirectly, and I think some of the ideas that we've touched upon do speak to the issue of creativity and do provide a way of thinking about it. And I just want to cover that kind of as an exercise in leveraging the theoretical material that we have. That said, there is a huge, huge body of scholarship on creativity, especially in the psychological branch of organization studies, which is deep and fascinating and definitely worth looking much more into. But that's, as I mentioned, something that falls a little bit outside of the scope of what we're trying to cover. But let's just try to use some of the ideas that we already have touched on to see what we can make of this creativity issue, this idea that ideas have to come from somewhere. Right. It's pretty reasonable to say that with the things that we've already worked on, good ideas are tremendously difficult to predict. Right. It's very hard to anticipate when good ideas will arise and what form they will have. Shane would probably say that good ideas are largely the result of something that you know in advance. So the way that you are, would kind of try to ensure that people can actually work creatively is to make sure that they have good opportunities for building up prior knowledge, and for looking beyond the particular context that they're working in. That ties in very nicely with Cohen and Leventhal, although they are talking about a different sort of prior knowledge. They still have this idea that the kind of stock of knowledge that you have, the amount of knowledge that you have on the mental shelf, so to speak, is going to matter for your ability to create something new. That kind of jives really well with the idea that innovation is not so much about the creation of novelty, but more about recombining things, which is something that you can see, for instance, in Dutton's work on strategic intuition. He's basically pushing this point, which is relatively widely accepted, that creativity is not so much producing novelty, pulling things out of the blue. It's much more about it's much more about recombining things in ways that haven't that they haven't been combined before. And you can kind of imagine that having lots of opportunities for combinations is going to be an asset in trying to put things together, right? So you want more ideas on the shelf. You want more prior knowledge. The second way that we could probably get to thinking about creativity would be based on Brown and Duguid. They would probably say that ideas sort of inevitably arise within communities of practice as people work with a set of problems. That is to say that it's not so much that you need to get people to be creative. They're sort of inevitably creative. March has kind of a bit of a tangential point in his paper, something that we haven't gotten into so much about this this way that if organizations continually get new employees into their organization and don't massage them through socialization into the organization's habitual thinking too much, then the kind of friction that will exist between their new thinking and the organization's habitual thinking will eventually just create these occasions for new ideas to arise, right? For both Brown and Duguid and March, it would thus not be so much a problem of getting people to be creative. Creativity sort of happens in those situations, either in communities of practice or in the confrontation between newcomers and established ways of thinking. The idea really, or the challenge would really be to identify and scale up the most valuable ideas. It's not so, in other words, your problem is not a lack of good ideas, it's a lack of good scaling. The third argument that we could probably develop from the things we've already read is the idea that creativity is largely a function of organizational structure, right? If we look at Abernathy's idea of the fluid organization, that's a way to organize that just makes it much more easy to be creative, while the specific structure makes it more difficult. Again, we can kind of have the idea that this particular sort of organizing, a little bit like what we just talked about with Brown, Duguid, and March, that this kind of structure just kind of lets new ideas emerge. So it's not so much, of course, the management intervention or the particular climate, but more the organizational design, so to speak, that can end up killing creativity, because creativity invariably is sort of there. The frame that the way that organizations built, so to speak, can't necessarily create creativity, but can certainly kill it. You can sort of drive out creativity, and you can beat the creativity out of people by putting them into sufficiently hostile environments. That said, there is a pretty significant body of psychological research that says that creativity is not something that you can actually take for granted. That there is kind of a system in which you can identify the most creative people, and that there are methods that you can use to push people to become more creative. One of the kind of, there's kind of an element of Zen in some of that reading, in that it's when you let go of trying to be creative that you can actually be most creative, that you can read about in this in the book that I just mentioned by Dutton on strategic intuition. There's also another really good book. Keith Sawyer has a book called Explaining Creativity, The Science of Human Innovation. That's a really good introduction to the psychological, and to somewhat lesser degree, the sociological research in the field, right? So in that sense, we are taking for granted that creativity will be there and that it can be driven out, but generally there can be arguments both for and against doing that. But basically, that's where we're gonna start. Okay. I should also say, right now we're leaving aside the questions of creativity, and moving on to the management of innovation processes, which is really what today's all about. What you are going to get here is largely a negative or critical story about the possibilities of managing innovation, or rather that the efforts to manage are going to have all kinds of unintended overflows. If you take the conventional story, the one that Cooper is kind of expunging, that's largely a positive story, right? That's really optimistic on behalf of management, in the sense that he believes that you can actually meaningfully talk about managing innovation processes, controlling them with a set of tools. Those tools will have more or less desirable effects, but they are definitely going to be relatively predictable. My reading of him is critical. I think lots of academics have that same critical reading. And it's also obvious, of course, that the practical state of the art has developed since Cooper quite a lot. And yet, lots of organizations still take some sort of stage gate-ish model for granted, right? I can't help but imagine that there are all kinds of unwanted and unintended side effects of a control tool, of a management tool like stage gate systems. And in my reading, in my understanding of innovation, as I've expressed that quite a few times, the management of innovation is going to be this very complex affair, and it's going to be much more complex than Cooper actually gives it credit for. And we're going to look back at some of our previous ideas that we covered in the course to see just what kind of complexity it is that we've talked about and how they would maybe challenge Cooper's way of thinking. The other texts that you're going to be reading are basically there to illuminate some of that complexity, right? For instance, for Cooper and the idea of stage gate systems, management accounting is a relatively unproblematic affair. It's something that can uncontroversially be applied to the innovation development process, right? If you look at the paper by Morrison and his colleagues, it's anything but trivial, right? It has all kinds of effects and affordances that change how the organization is going to innovate. Similarly, for Cooper, the stage gate model, the organization is sort of a passive receiver of management. The organization, so to speak, lets management happen to it. Whereas for Augstorfer, the organization is much more reactive, understood in the sense that innovation workers are going to continuously adapt the way that they work to the way that the organization seeks to control them. And so they're going to keep having the same agendas and interests that they're just going to pursue in new ways, reflecting the way that the organization tries to change or shift those agendas, right? But we kind of talked enough about Cooper's idea in its in a general form. Let's just try to look at what it is that he actually says, and then move on to some of the critiques of that. So basically, we should think about Cooper's ideas and the idea of the stage gate system as trying to solve a problem, a practical problem and not so much a theoretical problem. And that problem, I would argue, is basically Schumpeterian, right? So this is what he says in his paper, right? And this is, of course, reflecting his American position, and that he's writing mostly to an American audience, right? I quote, "America is in a product war, and the management of innovation is the strategic weapon. Battles take place on many fields, from electronic chips to tractors, cameras to machine tools, scientific instruments." Right? He writes at one point that the way that about how Japan is this huge threat to the U.S. And its self-identity as an industrial powerhouse, right? So Japan is the great other here, and the way that the U.S. as a whole is going to beat Japan is going to be through innovation, right? It has to do more and better and more efficient innovation. That's kind of reflecting the way that industrialized countries often talk about competing with developing countries with lower wages and lower production costs, right? So it's innovation that we have to do, and it's not just innovation; it's also, and it's like we're focusing on innovation, not so much the efficiency of our production, deeper specialization, or increased trade, as we would typically connect with exploitation, but exploration and new ideas, right? That's what we have to be good at. So in that sense, right, the Schumpeterian gale of creative destruction we would expect should blow much more strongly in the United States and the West than elsewhere, because essentially what we're trying to do is to compete through innovation. That's, we would imagine, how we can stay on top. That's kind of the way that the contest, as we think of it, is played out. So, that said, I do think that the type of metaphor is a little bit exaggerated, right? Talking about product wars, strategic weapons and battles, and to militarize what happens in business, I think it might be kind of good for the masculine self-esteem of the predominantly male-dominated executive suites, especially when what you think, when you look at what people often sell, it's pretty mundane. So as always, you should just kind of take that metaphor seriously, but not literally, right? Because it's really such a clumsy metaphor and can really misdirect your attention to what is going on. Anyway, so that's the setup, right? I think it's really worth paying some attention to what it is that Cooper actually means when he says that the management of innovation should be better, right? What is better? And you could understand that betterment in any number of ways, really. But Cooper understands it in a pretty particular way, right? He's interested in effective product innovation. Effective is kind of the thing to watch out for here. And what does that mean? He actually frames a little bit in different directions, right? So on the one hand, he argues that too many new products are not commercial successes. There are way too many misfires, way too many mistakes among innovations, and too many don't get to the market properly. Right? On the other hand, it's about the innovation process that needs to be more effective, right? Companies should drive new products to market faster with fewer mistakes and arguably at lower costs. Right? So that would be a different way of thinking about efficiency, that is not so much your ability to not fail, right? You could say you want to get a new product to market and you want it to succeed, right? So you want the success rate. That could be a metric of effectiveness. The other parameter could be that you want to drive products faster to market, right? So you want shorter development times. And finally, there's this idea that there's a need not just for extensions and incremental improvements, but new products that give the company a sustainable competitive advantage, as I was quoting, right? That's a different way of thinking about it, right? That's not about higher market success. It's not about faster development processes. It's about achieving more radical innovation. So there are quite many things that you can think about here. It's about what does it mean to get more effective? It means to have more market orientation, to develop innovations of a higher quality, of a higher novelty, or just through a faster process. Having read March, we can kind of think about these things and this lack of effectiveness as just a fact of life, right? It's a fact of doing explorative things. It's a fact of doing innovation. There is going to be much uncertainty. It's very easy to fail, and innovation takes time. It's kind of easy to avoid these things, but that is going to drive you towards exploitation. Right. So the question is, if we think about March, are these things that really can be optimized? And for Cooper, the response is actually a pretty resounding yes, right? He has a very strong confidence that this can be overcome. Much the same way that Tushman and Benner, for instance, had a pretty high level of confidence that you could actually move beyond the trade-off between exploration and exploitation, right? They thought you absolutely could. It's something about structural land by dexterity. Cooper has a pretty confident response to saying, yeah, you can actually you can do exploration in ways that are less uncertain, less risky, and a little faster. Quite a lot faster, even. So we have to ask him if he ends up addressing all the issues that he points out as he's solving March's Gordian knot of the fact of explorative life. Right. So the way that he gets at this is that Cooper starts with an understanding that innovation processes are a kind of production process. And kind of the derivative of that is that you can manage innovation processes as a form of production. That can seem sort of reasonable at the outset, right? It's about producing ideas. And that's actually pretty mainstream in economic research aimed at innovation, right? There's even pretty big economic literature about what's called the idea production function. I'm skeptical of that. I think it's based on some highly aggregated patterns and some theoretical elements that are going to be very difficult to measure in any meaningful way. But even if you don't want to go quite that far in saying idea production is a function of five different elements, you can actually take somewhat of a step and say, well, maybe innovation is not an actual production process, but it's not something that's completely special and ethereal and magic, right? It can be subject to some form of systematic leadership. And I think that's how you should understand what Cooper's trying to do with the stage gate model. But basically, for Cooper, the similarities between innovation processes and production processes mean that innovation processes can, of course, be managed. And they can be managed in ways that improve the outcomes. And the way that Cooper thinks about managing innovation is that innovation processes should really be seen as a series of distinct phases, much the same way that a production process is about doing certain things with raw materials and components and putting them together in sort of a series of phases. There are phases in innovation processes. That's what Cooper calls stages, that can be treated as their own sort of independent activity, where one does not necessarily automatically move from one stage to the next to the third, right? Rather, he wants to think as each phase ending with a sort of test, right? You want to see if the innovation project, the innovation idea, having fulfilled this stage, lives up to certain quality criteria that are going to be necessary in order for it to move on to the next stage, right? So there's a kind of deliverable that needs to get done in order to move from one stage to the next. And that transition point between phases or stages is what's called a gate. You have to metaphorically, right, be allowed to move through the gate towards the next stage. There are going to be gatekeepers at each gate that determine which projects move on. And going forward means that you get more resources to work with. Here you should think of March when he says the resources are what different innovation activities compete for, right? There are always scarce resources. How is it that choices are made between allocating those resources to different projects? This idea that you have to pass a test at the gate is why so many organizations today talk about writing business cases for both large and small projects before giving them any development resources, right? It's also kind of an idea that underlies very many different project management tools, even if they ostensibly don't talk about stages and gates, then there's still this idea that you have a project, it runs for a certain definite allotment of time, then there's some kind of evaluation. And based on how you deal with that evaluation, you can move on and get more resources, right? You can ask yourself why this is worth doing and why it's going to be important to do this. And I want to say that it's sort of important to understand that Cooper's empirical starting point is companies that have very, very large development costs up front and are characterized by each stage being dramatically more expensive than the other, right? So it's therefore very important in these organizations that you don't let a project go on for too long. You absolutely don't want a project to continue into the next phase if it's not going to be doing well because it's so expensive. It's prohibitively expensive to keep investing more in the project. The costs are going to be dramatically escalating from one stage to the next. The second idea to take seriously is that success in an innovation project is largely set up in the early stages of development. In his view, because of a lack of market understanding. And so his argument is that relative to the very large costs that come later in the project, market research early on would just be immensely cheap, and therefore it tends to be underinvested in, right? People don't allocate sufficient resources to doing market research at an early point in time. Especially considering the technical costs are often much, much higher than market research. It seems sort of strange that more resources are not used to ensure that your innovation actually fits with the real market demand, right? So that's kind of the way you want to think about it. You want to remember that the context he's talking about is one characterized by dramatically escalating costs and typically an underinvestment in market research upfront. Those are things he wants to kind of, that's part of the thing that he wants to solve. So that's kind of his project, right? You want to have these separate stages through the innovation process, and in order to progress from one stage to the next, you have to pass a gate which involves some kind of deliverable and some kind of managerial evaluation of how the project is doing, whether the innovation is worthwhile, and whether it deserves more resources, right? So what's going on in that solution in theoretical terms? It's obvious that he's kind of trying to apply a fairly solid structure on the innovation process, but what's that going to do and why does this matter? There's sort of a facile criticism that we can make of Cooper here, which consists of just saying that organizational practice is way much more messy and processual and unexpected, and there are many more reversals, and the boundaries between the stages are going to be leaky. And there are all kinds of things that just make the stage gate model an unrealistic way to manage innovation projects, right? It's not what organizations actually do. There's way too much uncertainty, way too many accidents, way too many flashes of insight, way too much unevenly distributed information for innovation processes to be manageable in this way. And I think this is a facile criticism because Cooper's answer, I think, would be that that's precisely the problem, right? If organizations are doing innovation in that way, they're doing it wrong. They're doing poor process management on their innovation processes. If organizations followed the stage gate system in a rigorous way, they wouldn't have the problem of this unruly process, right? So organizations aren't supposed to work in that chaotic way. They're meant to work in an orderly and much more machine-like way. The slightly better criticism that we could make is to kind of go in the direction and say that truly effective product management, truly effective product development, as found in, for instance, Toyota, right? We talked about Toyota last time. They're kind of the poster child for efficient development, is that the way they work is they work through much more concurrent processes. They don't have separate stages that sort of follow neatly from each other. They have more stages going on at once. much more concurrent forms of engineering, because there's simply too much waste of time in a process that constantly is waiting for others to get done with their processes. Cooper responds to that criticism by saying that concurrent method of product development is totally viable within his frame of thinking, but of course it's going to be more difficult, more complex to manage. He has this quote where he says, "The process is obviously more complex than the series approach, requires more careful management, and hence points to the need for a thoughtful game plan." Right. So that's not really a viable way to attack his argument either. But March, I think, can help us, because he would, I'm quite convinced, see something very specific and problematic in Cooper's model. So in March's terms, what is it that Cooper's doing? Well, he's basically trying to make exploration more exploitative, right? He actually says that when using his innovation as a production process metaphor. I'm going to quote, "The way to improve the quality of output from the process," and he's talking about the innovation process, "of course, is to focus on the process itself, to remove variances in the process." Now, if you think back to March's description, highlighting variance reduction was essentially what he was trying to do with exploitation. He was going to say that variance-enhancing activities essentially is what exploration is all about, creating increased variation. And reducing variation is exactly what exploitation is about. So what you're doing when you're using Cooper's model, in March's understanding at least, is that it's making it easier for organizations to explore by incorporating some of the most attractive parts of exploitation into exploration, right? By making the process more transparent, supposedly you're making it appear less uncertain. You're increasing the clarity of the future payoff from exploring when you're trying to account more deeply for it. But the flip side of that exercise is that at the same time, it can really make it much harder to fundamentally explore, because the uncertainty of exploration is irreducible. So you might end up only selecting those products that are really exploitative, right? If you have very, very definitive goals about how uncertain a project can be to move on to the next stage, then you might just be cutting yourself off from pursuing any of the more fundamentally explorative products. And that, as we know from Schumpeter, is kind of an unhealthy way to go if you're thinking about long-term survival, right? But the question, I think, is somewhat an empirical question. Do stage gate models actually increase an organization's ability to be explorative or exploitative, both or none of the two, right? The banal hypothesis you could have about that question is that the kind of management that gets done in stage gate systems is just going to kill creativity, because real-world creative products or projects can't be fitted into that formula. I'm sort of sympathetic to that argument, but I don't really think that's the biggest problem. For me, I think it just seems like people would adapt to the terms that they work under, but we'll get back to that when we talk about the idea of bootlegging. Also, I'm not entirely convinced that creative processes necessarily get killed by bad management. I don't necessarily believe that product developers are so susceptible to management. I think they might just have lots of ways to ignore the management that they're exposed to. And I think it reflects a little bit of a romantic ideal of what happens in innovation management when you just think that creativity can get killed off like that. I think there is there's an other angle that you can kind of think about as you're thinking about what it is that stage gate systems is going to do. While Cooper talks about this as being something that can speed up the innovation process, I think it can also very well be a process that slows it down dramatically. And in some context, which we will get back to when we talk about first mover advantages, that slowing down can be very dramatic and very not beneficial for organizations. All right, so a third angle that you could have, based essentially on Shane's idea, is that there could very easily be problems in passing the gate part of the stage gate model, because of asymmetric information. The gate model essentially assumes that the people who are going to be making evaluations at the gate point, the ones who are going to be gatekeepers, are going to be competent to do that, right? Where if you take up the idea of asymmetric information and take that really seriously, you would kind of assume that everyone is not going to have the same information or the same ability to make informed choices at particular gate evaluations. There could be very different understandings of an innovation's market relevance, depending on the prior knowledge that people have of the market context. There could be very different understandings of an innovation's technological feasibility, and the time it would take to develop an innovation based on people's prior technological knowledge, to use Cohen and Leventhal's idea, right? So we know basically from Christensen that evaluation of the market potential of new technologies is a very difficult thing to do, and something that is sometimes, maybe even often, resolved pretty badly, right? And that problem is going to persist as you move into stage gate models, right? You're going to have that challenge of making judgments in the stage gate or in the gate part of the model that can really be very decisive for the kinds of things that you end up developing. Right. So the question is, how do you ensure that those gates function in a way where good decisions get made? And I'm, as you can probably sense, a little bit skeptical about the possibility of doing that in a good way. So the question of what actually happens, whether stage gate models make innovation more explorative or more exploitative, whether it's going to kill off the right projects, what kind of effects you're going to have when you introduce it, depends not just on the tool itself, of course. It doesn't just depend on the model as Cooper describes it. It depends sort of on the larger sociology that the stage gate system is going to be part of. I don't want to go too much into that, but I do want to refer you to some of the work that John Christiansen at Copenhagen Business School has done on this, together with Klaus Varnes. They have a pretty good couple of articles on the subject, one of which is called Making Decisions on Innovation, Meetings or Networks, which came out in 2007 in the journal Creativity and Innovation Management. And they have a second paper from Management Decision from 2010, which is called What Attracts Decision Makers' Attention? Managerial Allocation of Time at Product Development Portfolio Meetings. Basically, they look at how a management tool like the stage gate system is actually used and not how it's used in kind of an idealized sense, and how decisions about allocation of resources are actually taken. Right? So you can say that's almost like the Brown and Dugrid approach of saying work as done by managers and not work as imagined. And we can kind of summarize what they found in a single sort of subtle sentence and say there are going to be lots of problems in implementing and managing Cooper's ideas in a systematic and well-functioning way. Right? With that, we're going to let Cooper and the stage gate model get some rest, and we're going to move on to the paper by Mowitz and Hansen.